Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today's program with best-selling author Karen Abbott was recorded live at the Hub Robeson Center at Penn State back in March. Abbott's visit was sponsored by Center County Reads, one community reading one book. The chosen book for this year's event was Abbott's 2014 book of creative nonfiction, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Undercover Women in the Civil War. Called a pioneer of sizzle history, her book interweaves the true stories of four women who risked everything on behalf of Union or Confederate sides.
I'll begin by asking you about the inspiration. The seed for Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy came to you in, of all places, a traffic jam on Route 400 in Atlanta. Tell us the story.
Well, I was born and raised in Philadelphia. I should say that the last time I was in State College, I had my fake ID taken away at the Raskeller. So it's good to be back here when I'm well over legal age of drinking. But I was born and raised in Philadelphia, and I moved down to Atlanta in 2001, and I lived there for 6 years. And it was quite a culture shock. I don't know if anybody here spent time in the Deep South. But, you know, you have to get used to seeing the occasional Confederate flag on the lawn, and you hear about the jokes of the War of Northern Aggression. And just the idea that the Civil War seeps into daily life and conversation down south in a way it never does up north. And this point was really driven home for me one day when I was stuck in traffic on Route 400, which is like the Dante's Seventh Circle of Hell in terms of Atlanta thoroughfares, for 2 hours behind a pickup truck with a bumper sticker that said, "Don't blame me, I voted for Jefferson Davis," who, of course, was the president of the Confederacy, and therefore had a long time to really start thinking about the Civil War in more detail. And my mind always goes to, well, what were the women thinking? And not just any women. What were the bad women thinking? What were the defiant women thinking? I figured, you know, there had to be some spies operating there. And sure enough, there was.
Before we find out more about the women in your book, I wanted to talk a little bit about the bad women, because your three best-selling books, from Sin in the Second City, which is the true story of the Everly sisters and their famous brothel, to American Rose, about the life and times of stripper Gypsy Rose Lee, you've brought all of these bodacious women to life in Technicolor. Actually, you blame your grandmother for setting you on that path. Is your grandmother still with you?
She is. She's 97. And has slowed down her storytelling ways, but she's actually the first one who got me interested in history. I was a journalist in Philadelphia and really more focused on covering, you know, modern day crime and occasionally, you know, baseball wives and things like that, which was always interesting. But she's the one who, her relative went missing in 1905, one of her mother's sister.
In Chicago.
And I started digging around about that relative and reading Chicago Tribune archives from 1905, and came upon the story of Marshall Field Jr. getting shot, Marshall Field Jr. being the son of the department store mogul. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Let me read more about that. And then, of course, I came upon a rumor that he was shot at the world's most famous brothel, where they began the tradition of drinking champagne out of a lady's slipper, and where they popularized the expression to get laid. The brothel was called the Everly Club, and patrons would reportedly say, "I'm going to get Everlyed tonight." Of course, then I forgot all about my missing ancestor, which sounds terrible, but I was much more interested in these two sisters who ran this brothel and the sort of national culture war that erupted in an attempt to shut it down.
You mentioned that it was your grandmother who sort of turned you on to the Civil War. And in fact, I was surprised to read that you didn't have a particular expertise or burning interest in the Civil War until you were looking at that bumper sticker. And so I'm kind of curious to know how, when we're talking about a subject where, according to the Library of Congress's Civil War desk reference, in 2002 there were 70,000 books written about the Civil War. How did you go about knowing this enough? Because obviously, in telling the story of these two Confederate and two Union women, you had to have a pretty good understanding of the Civil War.
Well, to be honest, I had to really start back at the beginning. I hadn't read anything about the Civil War since probably college or high school even. And the history books I read sure as hell didn't mention any female spies. So I thought, well, there's definitely a hole here to fill. There's a gap in the general people's knowledge of the Civil War. I guess it's not uncommon for women's history to be sort of shunted aside in favor of other topics, like, you know, Stonewall Jackson and Ulysses S. Grant. So it was a matter of just refamiliarizing myself with the generals and who won which battles. You know, then you start circling in and getting to the really juicy stuff, like the archival records and my spies' secret codes and the ciphers they used and the things that they hid in their crinoline and up in their hair, the really juicy espionage work. So it was sort of a matter of just working my way into that and then treating myself with it.
Before we find out more about all of that research, because you say original research, not what you'll find online, which has already been curated, is really your passion. USA Today described you as the pioneer of sizzle history. A lot of people look at that and think that's a sexist term. You say it was coined by a woman and you don't consider it sexist at all. What does that connote to you?
Well, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it possibly being connoted as sexist until somebody asked me that question. And to me, sizzle doesn't necessarily mean women. I took it to mean history that is not an academic tome, the history that might be engaging on a storytelling level. You know, history that reads like a narrative of the events happening rather than like a dissection of the events. So if when I try to write my books, I want them to read like a story. So that's really what I took that as more than anything else.
And in fact, that's exactly what this story, I think everyone will agree, that this is nonfiction that reads like fiction. And I wonder, because according to the nation's report card, only 12% of U.S. students are proficient in U.S. history, and I wonder if there were more sizzle history, if we would be, as a nation, more proficient, do better in history.
Well, I think I certainly would have been more interested in history had I, you know, known about some of these women's antics, although I would not recommend my book being read by grade school kids, so I will say that, so...
So let's talk a little bit about the four women who are featured in Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. You said to tell the stories of four women, and I'm wondering, four women whose stories sort of intersected and affected one another in some way or another. How did you settle on Belle Boyd and Rose O'Neill Greenhow, who represent the Confederacy, and Emma Edmonds, a.k.a. Frank Thompson, and Elizabeth Van Loo?
Well, I wanted four women, as you said, whose stories intersected. And I also wanted women who were coming from entirely different places, who had different perspectives, who were different ages, who had different motivations, and who had different levels of crazy. You know, some of these women were pretty bold and pretty brazen, and some of them were certifiable, I would think it's fair to say.
Belle Boyd.
Yeah. Who I love, by the way, but that's another issue. But, you know, I always want to, I don't care if characters are likable. You know, there's always a big discussion about whether female characters, especially female characters, should be likable. I don't care if characters are likable. I just want them to be interesting. I just want to know, you know, what they're going to do next. I want that kind of character. I also wanted to pick these four because there was the most primary source material. And in order to write books where you're telling a story rather than just an academic treatise, you really need that level of primary detail. You need memoirs, you need diaries, you need first-person interviews where you're actually getting a glimpse into these characters' thought process and what they were thinking in certain moments. And so that was also a huge, huge consideration.
So the fact of the matter is that three of these women actually did write memoirs or stories about their adventures. Elizabeth Van Loo is the only one who didn't, because she thought it was kind of a crass thing to do, but a history was written about her. But what I wonder is how you sorted out fact from fiction. And I ask that because there are lots of diary entries where soldiers wrote on a particular page, "I died today." And some of them actually did.
Yeah.
And some of them lived through that battle to live another day. So diaries aren't necessarily fact.
Yeah. It was a challenge in terms of some of them, especially with Frank Thompson or Emma Edmonds, one of the characters in the book, a woman who disguised herself as a man and enlisted in the Union Army as Private Frank Thompson. And she was quite a fascinating character. She actually gets involved with a love story with a fellow Union soldier that maybe we'll talk about. She was a challenge because there was a great tradition of self-mythologizing in the Civil War and afterward when people were writing their memoirs. And
they embellished.
Exactly. And she had a particularly interesting experience being a woman disguising herself as a man. And she made up a story, and I knew she made it up. She said that she was on the battlefield at Antietam. Her regiment was there. She was a nurse on the battlefield, and she came upon a soldier who was dying on the sidelines. And the soldier beckoned her over, and they could tell that each other was a woman. The dying soldier was a woman, and the other the dying soldier knew that Emma was a woman. And the soldier just begged Emma to keep her secret and to give her a dignified burial, and Emma promised to do so. Well, I looked up the regiment's history, and Emma's regiment was not on the battlefield at Antietam. And to me, what somebody omits or what they embellish or what they lie about is just as relevant and interesting as what actually happened. You know, what would be her motive for making up this story? And I can only, I surmise that, it was sort of a mirror reflection of what she was going through herself. This woman, as she portrayed her, was lonely, isolated, scared, and knew that she was in a precarious situation where if a female soldier was discovered, she could be arrested, she could be charged with prostitution. And Emma, I think, was just sort of unloading. It was a cathartic thing for her to write that she encountered a woman dealing with the same sort of thing. So then it just became a challenge of how to deal with it in the text.
The reality is that as many as 400 women disguised themselves as men from the North and from the South to take part in the Civil War. But a lot of people wonder, how on earth could a woman get through, first of all, the medical exam to enlist in the first place?
Yeah. It's a good question. I wondered that too. And the doctors, you know, across the country were charged with conducting thorough medical examinations, but they all flouted this rule. You know, they really only cared if you had fingers to pull a trigger, if you had teeth to rip off a powder cartridge, and if you had the feet to march. You know, these doctors had quotas to fill. They had to get the bodies out there quickly, and they just, that was the only things they cared about. So Emma Edmonds, aka Frank Thompson, passed that handily and then just faced the next challenge of passing among her comrades and the fellow soldiers she was with every day.
I think one of the most interesting stories about Emma Thompson is when the war was over and she was suffering from lots of health problems, she thought, you know, I contributed to this war, not just as a soldier and a nurse and other things. And she petitioned Congress for an army pension, and she got
it. Yeah. And it was a challenge for her. She had to write to all of her old male comrades and be like, guess what? I'm not exactly what you thought I was. And they were all really surprisingly kind to her and supportive of her and really went to bat on her behalf in terms of getting her a pension.
After the war, President Ulysses S. Grant really talked about his undying gratitude to Elizabeth Van Loo for all that she did to help the Union. And I'm just wondering, of the four women that you chronicle, who would you say made the greatest contribution to the war?
I think it definitely was Elizabeth Van Loo. Just to give you some background, Elizabeth Van Loo was a Union spy living in the Confederate capital of Richmond. And she had a rather interesting background. She was born in Richmond, but she was sent to Philadelphia to be educated, came under care of an abolitionist governess, and brought those ideals back with her. And as soon as her father died, she freed all of the family slaves. She began using her inheritance to buy slaves for the express purpose of freeing them. And when the war broke out, she decided to organize a Union espionage ring right under the nose of the Confederate government. And I think her greatest coup as a spymaster, her espionage network eventually spanned a few states. It was incredible. Her greatest coup was placing a former family slave as a spy in the Confederate White House.
Mary Jane Bowser.
Mary Jane Bowser, fascinating, fascinating character.
I was so interested when Mary Jane Bowser realized that she was being scrutinized and it was time to leave Jeff Davis's White House. I just wonder what danger she was in all of this time. And I think about Rosenberg, who was executed by the United States for espionage, and the person who turned her in was her brother and her sister-in-law. And Elizabeth Van Loo was under similar circumstances with a sister-in-law in her house who was an ardent Confederate.
Yeah.
So these two women really were in terrific danger.
Well, Elizabeth had approached Mary Jane and sort of let her know what she wanted her to do. And Verena Davis, the first lady of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis's wife, had put out a call saying, I need help. I need staff to run my household. I need some assistance here. Does anybody have a reliable servant they could send over? So Elizabeth pays her a social visit and says, well, I have a girl for you. She's not very bright and she stumbles in the kitchen, but she's loyal and she'll serve your family well. And she sends over Mary Jane Bowser. Now, little did anybody know that Mary Jane Bowser was not only literate, but highly educated and gifted with a photographic memory. So while she's dusting Jefferson Davis's desk, she's also peeking at his confidential papers, you know, and reporting all this back to Elizabeth. And as for the danger, I think that she knew that the Confederacy might be a little bit more lenient with a white woman at the time, but I don't think that they would have had this.
Especially from the upper crust.
Especially from the upper crust. And that was the thing. Somebody of Elizabeth, who was from one of the wealthiest families in Virginia, was considered above suspicion. You know, she was too much of a lady. She was too much of a gentlewoman to be stooping to treasonous activity. And that was the reason she got away with a lot. But somebody like Mary Jane Bowser, who they didn't even believe could read, you know, she was below suspicion for a lot of the time. They didn't think she'd be capable of such treacherous, treasonous activity.
If you're just joining us, I'm Patty Satalia, and this is Take Note on WPSU, recorded live at Penn State's Hub Robeson Center with visiting author Karen Abbott. Abbott's book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Undercover Women in the Civil War, was this year's Center County Read Selection, One Community Reading One Book. It was named one of the best books of 2014 by Library Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, and Amazon, and it was optioned by Sony for a miniseries.
So why do you think women throughout history have made such good spies?
Especially during the Civil War, they really used their gender as both a physical and psychological disguise. You know, physically, they hid messages up in their hair. They hid weapons around their hoop skirts and smuggled them across the lines and all sorts of things, you know, smuggled their hoop skirts. And psychologically, anytime somebody accused them of treasonous activity or dared to question them, how dare you? How dare you accuse me of such behavior? I am a defenseless lady. And of course, they were the furthest things from a defenseless lady, but it was something, a response that really put the accuser on the defensive and made them reconsider their line of questioning. So
it sounds like Mary Jane Bowser actually went on to lead a good life. But for someone like Elizabeth Van Loo, her life was really, she gave up everything. She sacrificed everything for this. She ended up in poverty, basically.
Yeah, it was such a shame. Here's somebody who should really be a household name. This is somebody who contributed.
Why isn't she in the history books?
As much as Ulysses S. Grant or, you know, Robert E. Lee for the Confederates. I mean, this is somebody who, the North would not have won the war without her. It's just sort of a shame that the government couldn't even step up and really assist her at the end. And I think a part of her was stubborn and said, I am not leaving Virginia. You can't drive me out of Richmond. Of course, after the war, all of her neighbors who had threatened her life during the war were still, you know, pretty mad at her. They were pretty pissed.
Talk a little bit about how the Civil War changed the lot for women.
I think that it's a really good question. And it was really great to read some of the stories about women. You know, they had this all this hardship, of course, that accompanied the war. Their husbands were gone, their brothers were gone, their uncles were gone, their fiancés were gone. But at the same time, the men were gone. Woo, the men were gone. So it was sort of like Civil War girls gone wild, you know? And, you know, there was great letters I found in some diaries where the poor men would say things like, well, Mary Lou's expecting, you know, she's due in September. Meanwhile, the guy hadn't been home in like a year. And I'm just like, oh, the math, you're not getting this math here. And I really think the Civil War laid the groundwork for the civil rights, women's rights movement toward the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century leading up to suffrage.
In a way, I can't help thinking about how relevant these women's stories are to today. These women wanted to matter. They wanted to do something of significance. And the Civil War and this espionage allowed them to do that. And I sometimes think, you know, when someone becomes a suicide bomber or, you know, disguises themselves and under a jihad and, you know, becomes involved in other things, is some of the same stuff at play here?
Yeah, I think that, you know, women weren't allowed to have political discourse. They weren't allowed in public without a chaperone. They had all of these confines and restrictions on their lives. And the Civil War, you know, it was, you know, they were sort of desperate to find a way to channel their energy to support their cause. And it really led them to do a lot of risky things and literally, you know, sacrifice everything.
Speaking of risky things, Belle Boyd, who you describe, by the way, as a psychopath on spring break, which is quite the description, she was so bodacious, I couldn't get over some of what you recounted. She would, with her spy ring, take all of the ammunition and arms and weapons from Union soldiers and hide things in her crinoline, unbelievable things that she would steal from the Union soldiers and give to the Confederates.
Oh, yeah. She was one of the South's, I guess, most important inland blockade smugglers and would creep around at night gathering weaponry. And I think the 28th Pennsylvania awoke one day to discover that, you know, 1,400 muskets, 200 sabers, and just as many rifles were gone, awaiting transfer to Southern lines. And Belle Boyd was just a really sort of interesting character. She was very overt with both her opinions and her sexuality, which was very rare for a 17-year-old girl at the time. Another thing I like to call her is if Sarah Palin and Miley Cyrus had a 19th century baby, it would have been Belle Boyd. You know, she was just sort of out there. She was all in. She just had no filter.
And in fact, I think today it would be safe to say that there would be a mental health diagnosis.
Yes.
And she did end up in a mental health institution.
She did.
Where she gave birth to her son.
Yeah, she had some problems, I'll put it that way. Made for some good stories, though.
It certainly did. Talk a little about putting together this jigsaw puzzle. What went into figuring out how you would weave this story together?
Well, physically, I live in Manhattan now. I live in like a 600 square foot, tiny, cramped little apartment. And, you know, at some point, this manuscript was, you know, 400 some pages. I literally have to spread this out just to try to see where the pieces go. I'm sort of a tactile person and wanted to physically look at it. And, of course, my husband came home from work that day and wasn't allowed to walk anywhere because I had various piles, you know, they could not be shifted or moved. But it was, you know, part of the fun for me is sort of figuring that out and figuring out where their stories touch. You know, they were always running into the same people. You know, for example, Belle Boyd has this great scene where she has this encounter with, if anybody has ever heard of General Benjamin Beast Butler. He was an infamous Union general who was in New Orleans. The Southerners hated him so much that they took their commode and got his face painted on the bottom of their toilets. and were, you know, that was their big statement. Belle Boyd has this encounter with him in which she tells him off, tells him exactly what she thinks of him. And in the very next scene, he's recruiting Elizabeth formally to become a Union spy. And so there were a lot of sort of interesting connections like that.
There are rumors that Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy has been optioned by Sony for a miniseries, and that often happens with authors. Their story is purchased, and it doesn't always come to fruition. Can you give us an update on what's happening with this story?
Well, it was optioned, so fortunately the rumors are true. But, I mean, as a writer, you try never to really think about it because you'll drive yourself nuts willing it to come true. But, of course, I always cast it in my head.
So who's Belle Boyd?
Well, I'm sure she has nothing else going on, so Jennifer Lawrence would be a great Belle Boyd, I think. I think Hilary Swank for Elizabeth would be great. Reese Witherspoon, I'm sure she's not busy either, for Rose. And Ellen Page, I think, for Emma would be really great. And maybe Kerry Washington for Mary Jane Bowser.
So can you tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on? And the next rumor is that rather than nonfiction, you're thinking of telling a story from the Gilded Age, but as fiction.
Well, I started that, and then my mind found the shiny new object, which was nonfiction. So I just sold another nonfiction book. It's about the country's most successful bootlegger in the 1920s, before Al Capone.
It was a woman, I'm assuming?
No, it was a man. But the female district attorney, 32-year-old woman, 5 years out of law school, is the one who brought him down. So it's just sort of, there's some murder, there's a love triangle, there's revenge, and lots of drinking, which is always fun. So,
So you give a lot of workshops helping people interested in writing nonfiction, and of course you've given a lot of advice to young writers. I'm imagining that there are some in this audience right now. What's the best advice you've ever gotten? And what's the best advice you can give this audience right here?
Well, if you're interested in writing nonfiction, I think the key to that is gathering the details. You know, if you're writing nonfiction, you can't try to be funny, you can't try to be poignant, you can't try to be compelling. You have to let the details do that work for you. So the big work is gathering the details. And one of the reasons I love nonfiction is because you find things that are, you know, stranger than fiction. It's true. The adage is true. For example, here's something I could not have made up, and if I had made it up, people would have, you know, pillorized me for it. One of Belle Boyd was a notorious seductress, as crazy as she was. She seduced Union men, Confederate men, anyone, all ranks. And one of her reported paramours was a man by the name of Major Dick Long, which... I always feel like a 12-year-old boy telling that, but I read this newspaper article and I was like, are you kidding me? So I had to put it in there. But the details are really important. And chronology, you're not writing fiction, but you can use novelistic techniques. You can cut off at suspense point. You can build tension. You can sort of use novelistic methods to build a story and to build a narrative.
And in fact, with American Rose, you said you sort of put it together as a striptease so that you weren't revealing everything all at once.
Yeah, I didn't want that book. It was about Gypsy Rose Lee, the famous burlesque star. It wasn't a biography to me. To me, it was a microcosm of 20th century America. Here's somebody who had been in American entertainment from vaudeville in 1911 to the Vietnam War. One of her last acts was to entertain the troops at Vietnam. And just sort of the craziness that accompanied that and the changes that culturally were happening in America all through her perspective. And it was sort of the perfect life to look at that. And it sort of lent itself to a striptease. She was not somebody who lived in a linear fashion. Her life was all over the place. And I wanted to reflect that a little bit.
And real quickly, your life, you began, as you said, as a journalist in Philadelphia. You worked as a journalist for 6 years. How difficult was that transition to long form nonfiction?
Oh, it was terrible.
And to what extent did that early background in journalism aid you in your research and your writing long-form nonfiction?
That's a good question. When I was writing journalism, I was at Philadelphia Magazine, and you could write long pieces. I mean, I think that I've written, like, my longest piece was about 10,000 words. So writing a book just became, I'm just writing an extended magazine piece. Of course, it's a little different than that, but that's the basis you come from. But publishing, you know, writing is fun and researching is the most fun, but publishing is not fun at all. It's a brutal business. I wrote 2 books before I sold my first book. And when I was on submission the last time, if this doesn't sell, I'm going to quit. I was so stressed out, I developed like an allergic reaction to myself. like broke out in hives everywhere to the point where I had to go to the emergency room.
And then 3 New York Times bestsellers in a row.
Whenever I hear about somebody trying to break into publishing, it's like, I'm just like, don't get stress hives, calm down, you know, it's all going to be okay. It's lucky, you know, it's in a combination of luck and timing. And of course, you know, sitting your butt in the chair and doing the work, but publishing is a lot about luck and timing. And I got lucky.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for coming.
That was author Karen Abbott, who legally changed her name to simply Abbott. She is the author of Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, 4 Undercover Women in the Civil War, which was this year's Center County Reed selection. Abbott is a native of Philadelphia, and she's the best-selling author of Sin in the Second City and American Rose. To hear more of this interview, including Q&A from the audience, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.